Welcome to Stepping Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and my guests today are from the organization called Critical Resistance. Critical Resistance is a national grassroots group that fights to end the prison industrial complex by challenging the belief that policing, surveillance, imprisonment, and similar forms of control make our communities safer. And we're going to talk more about that. I'm just reading from the brochure there. My guests are Rachel Herzing and Rose Braz. We are in Oakland, California. I think we'll start out by talking about the prison industrial complex, because although we in the San Francisco Bay Area hear that term a lot, especially starting with a conference, a huge conference at the University of California a few years ago, I'm not sure that most people even know what it means. So let's just start there. Who wants to begin? Rachel.
Basically, when I talk about the prison industrial complex, what I'm talking about are the intersections that we see kind of between the interests of business and the government to convince us that we need these institutions like prison, like policing, like surveillance, to keep us safe. And they do that in a number of different ways. They do that through creating more and more legal challenges so that we feel, you know, that we're unsafe if we're in the streets. And so we have, you know, laws that protect us in that way. And we kind of have more and more laws as we go along. We have kind of bigger and better and more, you know, technologically advanced prisons and jails. So we have things like supermaxes now, which are kind of for the worst of the worst, you know, supposedly. They do that through the media by convincing us kind of that crime is the number one issue in our country, when in fact crime rates continue to fall.
You say crime rates continue to fall, and I know that most people, I just want to underline it, yeah. That even though more and more prisons are being built and this fear is being fed, the crime rate is indeed falling.
Exactly, yeah. And so I think what I talk about when I talk about the prison industrial complex is kind of the intersections of all of these different interests toward kind of social control, toward making us feel insecure, and that there's this need, kind of justifying this need for more incarceration, for more policing.
I think that is what the prison industrial complex is we're not just talking about a single thing, we're more talking about a system. One thing I would add, I think, is, you know, people are beginning to focus more on and recognize more that these systems, prisons, policing, surveillance, are being instituted as an answer or a solution to what are social problems of drug addiction, poverty, unemployment, undereducation. And there's a recognition, I think, by the public that to look elsewhere for those answers.
Tell me something about the programs that you have or what it is that you do. You're the two staff members of Critical Resistance, the organization here, and maybe you want to tell a little bit about the history. I don't know if that's so important, but as important as what you're doing now.
Just really briefly, Critical Resistance started in 1997 when a group of folks came together, former prisoners, activists, academics, cultural workers, grassroots folks, came together to organize a conference to examine the phenomenon of the prison industrial complex. And we started organizing thinking, well, it would be great if we could get 500 people together to discuss this, you know, because prisons and criminal justice issues were pretty low on the, you know, scale of what was going on in the left at that time. And so we ended up with a conference of over 3,500 people that literally came from all over the world. And in the process of organizing that conference, came to realize that what was needed was far more than a conference or a gathering, but an actual movement and organization, and that's where Critical Resistance was born from. Subsequent to that, folks on the East Coast organized Critical Resistance East, which took place in March 2001 in New York City, which similarly drew thousands of people to come together, and it was much more a strategy session, whereas in 98, I think we were examining and defining this phenomenon. In 2001, we were strategizing and coalition building and coming together as to how to fight against it. And right now, we're actually organizing with folks across the South for Critical Resistance South, which is going to take place April 4th through 6th, 2003 in New Orleans.
Great. So could you give some examples of specific things that are going on? And I want to say that at least here in California, and I know this is not the only state, when we started seeing more money being spent on prisons than on schools, just that little fact alone is should tell people a lot, which, as far as I'm concerned, should be and should have been alarming. So I just want to put that in there.
Yeah, one of the things that's come out of these conferences, we plan conferences with a strategy in mind. So more than merely just getting people together, the idea is that building for this event is an organizing strategy, and it entails having people work together to learn more about the issues, to figure out who's working in the region, to really get people hooked up and focused on, you know, kind of one thing for a moment, but then the idea being that they go from there with more tools than they came with, and they go back to the work that they're already doing, because there's amazing grassroots work going on around the PIC all over this country. We really see it as kind of an organizing opportunity. And one of the things that came out of both the 98 conference and the 2001 conference was that these kind of local groups started sprouting up. And as a result of the 2001 conference, there are local chapters throughout the East Coast.
Local chapters called Critical Resistance.
Exactly.
Fighting the Prison Industrial Complex.
That's exactly right, yeah, called Critical Resistance. And the way that we're set up is we're kind of a national organization, but our organizing takes place locally and is really defined by what the local issues are in each particular spot. And the prison industrial complex has many different faces in different places in the country. So that can mean, you know, fighting prison construction and potential prison construction, as we're doing here in California. That can mean working on finding places for people to live when they come out of jails and prisons, and fighting, you know, unfair housing practices such as the federal one strike law, which says that people with drug convictions and violent crime convictions, and that's defined very loosely, cannot have access to public housing. So that's what they're working on in New York City. In Kentucky, they're working on issues that are much more related to families of prisoners. So they're doing things around schools. They're doing visitation projects. In New Haven, Connecticut, they're working on the MCI, the way in which MCI, which is the service provider of telephones for the prisons there, jails and prisons there, is gouging, you know, families, and so kind of trying to get a sense of what families are feeling about that and how to move from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so many issues that people don't who aren't involved with somebody in prison or who haven't been in prison themselves just don't even think about. And when you say the complex, there's all these big businesses, like you just talked about, the phone company, and people are locked up, so they're basically a captive, literally a captive population there, and anything can happen. And also, I'd like to know what's going on in terms of businesses, corporations using prisoners as workers at low wages. Rose, would you like to talk about that?
Well, there is this phenomenon of prison labor, although it's not as big as I think a lot of people think it is. It's definitely, you know, unfair business practices in that prisoners, while they get paid a certain amount, also get gouged for everything from housing is taken out of their salaries. In Virginia, prisoners have to pay back the lunch bill for the jury that convicted them. Medical care, blah, blah, blah. So what's happening is prisoners across the country are working for both private companies and for prison industry authorities within the state and federal government, which is the federal government branch is called Unicor, producing products that are sold and profits go to the government or private companies, but the wages are not given to the workers who are the prisoners. So prison labor is a problem, although it's not on the scale, I think, of you know, that maybe some people have been led to believe. I think there are far more serious issues around the number of people who are in prison in this country, which is nearly 2 million today.
Okay, well, just for my own self, I mean, maybe I have an exaggerated idea about prison labor, but my impression was that the prisoners got paid something like 13 cents an hour, that there are some corporations, some technology corporations, that Victoria's Secret, for instance, that sexy lingerie is made in prison, that there were airline offices that where the people who answer the phone are in prison. So would you just elucidate some of that so I won't be misinformed?
Well, all of that is true, that those things are happening and that prisoners end up with, you know, slave labor wages for the work they do. And under the 13th Amendment, slavery has been abolished in all cases except for those in prison. I mean, the 13th Amendment says that. So that is very true. In practice, however, it's a fairly small percentage of the prison population that is actually engaged in that type of labor. Mm-hmm. And that has to do with a number of factors. Simple things like a manufacturing company sets up a business inside of a prison, for example. You can't bring a semi-truck into a prison because you can't have two gates open at the same time. So how do they get their stuff out? Every time there's a lockdown in a facility, and here in California in the Central Valley, anytime there's fog in the Central Valley, the prison goes on lockdown, which means prisoners can't go to work. And that happens a lot in the Central Valley. So there are a lot of practical impediments to prison labor that has kept it, you know, a fairly small part of the prison industrial complex, but nonetheless a part that we fight.
Mm-hmm. And it's a complicated thing because a lot of times prisoners would rather be working and rather be than sitting around doing nothing and rather get 13 cents an hour or whatever than nothing. And yet it's really, it seems to me, and I'm talking away here because I have strong feelings about this and I've been looking at these issues for a while, that it looks like our tax money is supporting the prisons that they are then supporting the corporations. Is that incorrect?
I think that's correct, but I think as Rose points out, in the big scheme of things, for all of the issues that affect all of the nearly 2 million people locked up in this country, it's a relatively small number. And I mean, work is still a privilege in the bulk of, you know, places in this country. So you're right that most prisoners, I think, would like to be able to work, but are, you know, don't have the opportunity to leave their cells even to do that. So I think all of that's true. But I also think that, you know, in the big scheme of things, it is still a very, very small percentage. And I think that's one of the misconceptions about what the prison industrial complex is. I think when people hear that phrase, they often think, oh, that's prison labor that they're talking about because they hear the industry. And I like to focus on the complex part of it because I think, you know, the point that we're trying to make in using that phrase and trying to make that phrase commonsensical is that it's really, really multifaceted, and it has all of these different parts. And labor, obviously, is one of those, you know, from convict lease on until the current day. But it's still one of many, many, many parts.
Okay, well, I'd like to remind people that my guests, Rose Braz and Rachel Herzing, work with Critical Resistance here in Oakland, California, and we're talking about the prison industrial complex, which is what they, the issue that they're working with here. So talk some more about the issues that you do think are most important, if you would.
Well, I think one thing about the prison industrial complex is, and what we've been working to do, is to illustrate how it impacts folks who are concerned about many different things in our society. For example, you pointed out the school trade-off, the education trade-off that goes on in terms of budgeting for prisons and education. We've been working around the environmental impacts of prisons and been able to make coalitions that include the NAACP and the Rainforest Action Network fighting this prison plan for Delano, California, as an example. We've been able to talk about labor issues because of prison labor issues and the fact that, you know, again, budgets are impacted. State employees, our salaries are being impacted by the amount of money that goes into corrections, particularly in California, where you've got a $5 billion prison budget. So I think that another thing to recognize in terms of the prison industrial complex and our organizing is that this issue impacts people who are concerned about a lot more than just people in prison. And that's another reason why we use that term. And we're not just about fighting prisons. Mm-hmm. We're about fighting the system.
Right. Yeah, and of course, again, I'll underline that everything that goes into prisons doesn't go into something else, just like with the military. Is it still the case that California, and we don't want to focus too only on California here, but that California has more people in prison proportionately than anywhere in the history of the world, any place in the history of the world, except maybe China? Do you happen to know that? Because I say that a lot. I wouldn't like to be wrong.
Yeah. No, it does have one of the highest incarceration rates per capita of any country, if you look at, you know, even countries, the whole world, much less states. And Texas is quite up there with us also. And California seeks to expand that, you know. So absolutely, California is a nation unto itself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the old phrase, the way California goes, so goes the rest of the nation. I think there's some truth to that. And we're hoping that, you know, here with the passage of a recent proposition that provided for alternatives to incarceration for people convicted of drug offenses. We're seeing some of that go nationwide also, and taking from other states that are, you know, right now states across the country are actually canceling prison projects, cutting back on people in prison, revamping sentencing to reduce their prison budgets. And unfortunately, what you're having is California not following suit, and largely because of the influence here of the prison guards union. So,
which is the most powerful, biggest union in California, I understand.
Yeah, the Prison Guard Union in California is the number one contributor to state legislative races of any union, private company, individual, number one. They gave $2.3 million to Governor Gray Davis and endorsed him, and have received several thank you presents, including most recently a 34% pay hike in the midst of a $23 billion budget shortfall. So that's pretty much all you need to know. You know.
Oh, is there another issue? I mean, I have so much to say. I don't want to hog the interview. You're the guest. Is there another issue that is that you want to mention right now?
Sure.
Rachel?
I think
an issue for me is not so much an issue, a specific issue of the prison industrial complex, like labor, for instance. But the thing that I really do want to make sure that we get to, because I think what makes us slightly different from a lot of other people who work on these issues, is that we our organizing is centered around finding concrete steps to actually eliminating the system, ultimately. And really making, again, that commonsensical and that realistic, and not making it science fiction, but saying there are concrete steps that we can take from, you know, the neighborhood level to the state level to the national level to decarcerate, to make communities safer without having to lock people up, put people in cages, put people in restraints. And figuring out how to do that, you know, site by site in ways that make most sense to the community. And I think one of the things that we're really trying to do is to kind of push that, you know, in every single issue that we talk about, figure out, okay, well, what are the alternatives then to policing? What are the alternatives to imprisonment? What are the alternatives to surveillance every single step of the way? And I think what we're seeing is a real transition, you know, these things that Rose pointed out in terms of, you know, states, governors, and legislatures across the country closing old prisons down and decarcerating and trying to figure out ways to change sentencing. And I think that's a really great trend. And so I definitely want to highlight that and, you know, say that that seems to be in step with crime rates continuing to fall and prison populations continuing to fall. That makes good sense. And I would love, you know, to see our state of California also be able to follow suit. And I think it's a real aberration and a real embarrassment for the state of California that we've gone so far afield from what seems to be the national trend.
Well, and we haven't really mentioned racism, and of course so many people in prison are poor, and people of color, particularly African Americans and Latinos, and a lot of people are innocent. It's becoming clearer and clearer. So somebody told me that in New York, and maybe this is what you were just referring to too, that in some say New York. Yeah, they were going to let out first offender drug offenses that were not violent. And, of course, in Illinois, I think they're talking about dropping the death penalty. So many people have been found innocent that have been on death row and are really innocent. And so much of this has to do with if you can afford a good lawyer and just the racism in the system.
Yeah, I mean, clearly the racism infects the system at every level, and I think that's another important phenomenon of the prison industrial complex. There's this statistic that we like to use because it's so illustrative, to me at least, that, you know, African Americans represent about 14% of drug users nationally, which is on par with their representation in the general population. Yet they represent 33% of those arrested for drug crimes, 55% of those prosecuted for drug crimes, and 75% of those who go to prison for drug crimes. So I think that statistic talks about the way racism infects the system from the point where someone is stopped on the street in their neighborhood, right, by the police and arrested and then chosen to be prosecuted and then chosen for the stiffest sentences. So you end up with a prison population that, you know, is phenomenally disproportionate, you know, and reflects the racism in the system at every level.
And, of course, so once somebody goes to prison, that's not a very nice experience, especially for a young person in formative years. The United States, I want to let people know, too, is one of the three countries in the world that executes children, which is really shocking, and most people don't know that.
Yeah. One thing that I'd just like to add about a point that you made earlier is that, for me, the system doesn't work. It doesn't work equally for people who have committed crimes as well as for people who are so-called innocent. I think, you know, one, if we think about the way that we police our communities and the, you know, kind of the structural inequalities that we work from to begin with, I think the whole concept of innocence is really suspect to me, right? Because it assumes that there is some kind of level playing field. It assumes that there people are going to be policed equally. It assumes that people are going to get equal representation in courts and all of that. And, you know, even for those people who do commit acts against other people and against other people's property, the system does not work. So that, I think, is a really important thing to highlight, too, is that it's not just that, you know, it's a great system for those people who act out against other people, and it's not a great system for, you know, the innocent, but that we need to figure out a way to keep people from going into cages in the first place, and to figure out ways to actually make communities healthy and safe so that people don't find themselves in situations that would lead them to eventually end up in cages.
Mm-hmm. And when you say the crime rate's going down, does that have anything to do with that so many people are locked up, do you think?
Well, actually, there's really interesting. This Justice Department, in other words, the Department of Justice of the federal government, just released a study last week which found that the nation's prison building boom did absolutely nothing to deter crime. The Sentencing Project did a study which showed that states with more prisons and more people in prisons actually had higher crime rates than states with fewer prisons and fewer people in prisons. And there is absolutely no relationship between locking people up and reducing the crime rate, as, you know, crime rates currently at their lowest level per capita since 1964. Mm-hmm. That's a huge fact that if you watch the TV news, you would never, ever guess.
Well, I don't watch the TV news, and I listen to more progressive stuff, and I would never have known that. Since 1965, this is the lowest crime rate. That is definitely really important for people to know. So that means that in fact, it is safer. a lot of the fear stuff that's going on all the time, and of course we haven't even, and maybe we don't want to talk about people being locked up without lawyers and charges and all that sort of thing that's happening with these tribunals now. I think we don't have time to go into that unless you want to say something real quick, because we just have a very short time left. But is there anything you want to say about programs going on? Maybe you want to talk with this, Rachel, and other parts of the country that are that you've mentioned several times about things that we can do to make life even safer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, the first thing is to figure out what your priorities are. So, you know, for those people who don't feel safe, what would make them feel safer? Would it be, you know, knowing their neighbor, or having an alternative to go to instead of having to call the cops. Because I think for the bulk of people I talk to, the cops don't necessarily make them feel any safer. So,
well, you haven't talked about police brutality.
So, I mean, I think, you know, one is to figure out your priorities. For us, in the places where we have local chapters, there's ongoing work happening that people can plug into, and people, you know, can contact us to figure out, you know, what's a good match for them in terms of their region.
And we're going to let you know how to do that in 1 second, so get ready if you want to write down how to contact Critical Resistance. But go ahead and make your point, then we're going to have to make these, give out these contact possibilities and close it up.
Yeah, so I would just say, you know, figure out what the priorities are and then take active steps to creating a world that you actually want to live in, and to kind of counteracting the fear that we keep getting fed from the government, even though, as Rose points out, their statistics show that crime rates keep declining, to counter what you see on the television news, because crime always leads, even though, you know, our society actually is a much safer place than it's been. So I would really just say, you know, figure out what the positive steps are that you can take to actually make the world that you want to live in.
That sounds like a good idea. I'd like to add to that and say that, you know, while you're growing your gardens and living sustainably and being safe, all these kinds of things that we have to basically or need to kind of create the kind of society we want, because and think more critically, because why are they the powers that be so intent on making us feel more afraid? Mm-hmm. Does anybody want to comment on that and then give your contact?
Yeah, I mean, I think that as Rachel pointed out earlier, there's a lot of different interests at play that stand to profit both financially and politically from locking up more people, you know, and what we need to do is debunk the myths that allow them to do that and convince the public that it's a good idea. And I think we are doing that. And, you know, there was a recent poll that was conducted last week that showed 58% of California voters support a freeze on prison construction. And, you know, the number one area people want to cut is prisons. So these things, along with the passages of various propositions that are looking toward alternatives to imprisonment, I think give us hope, you know, for the organizing we're doing.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Rachel Herzing and Rose Braz from Critical Resistance. And I'm going to give you that contact now. The webpage is a good old www.criticalresistance.org. So that's easy enough, criticalresistance.org. The phone number here in Oakland, California is 510-444-0484. That's 510-444-0484. And my name's Sue Supriano. Thanks so much, Rachel and Rose. Thank you for listening.